supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Since Monday night, a group of protesters has been camped out in front of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement field office in Center City, Philadelphia. Police arrested 7 demonstrators this afternoon as they attempted to break up the encampment, but the protesters continue to press on. One of their focuses is ending a contract between ICE and the city, as WHYY's Darrell C. Murphy explains.
Even after police cleared out the encampment at 8th and Cherry Streets, the protesters continued their calls to abolish ICE, the agency that arrests and deports immigrants in the country illegally. They are also calling on Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney to end the city's contract with ICE that gives the agency access to a real-time arrest database. Mara Enal is a member of the Philly Socialists. She said the contract isn't worth risking the safety of undocumented residents.
And it's just messed up that Philadelphia is a sanctuary city, but then it's still like giving information that is putting people in danger. And yeah, and like the financial incentive is not even enough to, you know, defend this kind of like decision making.
Every 2 years, ICE pays the city about $5,500 to access what's known as the Preliminary Arraignment Reporting System. A defendant's immigration status is not included in the database, but it does include their name, address, place of birth, and upcoming court dates. Defense attorney Susan Lynn says ICE can use the information to draw conclusions about a person's citizenship.
The problem is when there are other just sort of plain old identifying information that become code for somebody's status.
ICE can use this information to track down undocumented immigrants it wants to report. The next 2-year contract is up for renewal on August 31st. A spokesperson for the city says the administration has not decided whether to continue it and is weighing its options. For WHYY, Darrell C. Murphy.
After a water main break in Center City, Philadelphia Tuesday sent 15 million gallons of water rushing through the streets, some of the affected bars and restaurants are starting to reopen. But as Jim Saxa of WHYY's Plan Philly reports, no one knows yet just how big the repair bill will be or who will end up paying it.
Inside OPA, a half dozen fans are working to dry the dining room floor. Tim Lennon of Royal Water Damage is sitting at the bar doing paperwork while his crew continues to clean up the bar's basement.
It's mostly work down in the basement. Some of the buildings had 4 to 6 feet of water. This particular one had 2.5 feet of mud and chicken grease.
It may take 5 days to finish the cleanup. The work is hot, messy, stinky, and not cheap.
It's expensive. We're talking thousands and thousands of dollars.
This part of Center City is packed with bars and restaurants. Kate Maroney-Miller of the Vintage Syndicate oversees operations at a handful of them, including 2 on Sansom with flooded basements, Time and Bar.
It's pretty devastating. The beating heart of the business is the basement. It's where all of the refrigeration units are. It's where the compressors for air conditioning units are, beer systems, soda systems, not to mention all of the product.
It'll take some time for Time to reopen, says Maroney Miller. And fixing and replacing all that equipment will cost a lot of money.
Loss of business aside, just in terms of damages at Time, you're well beyond 6 figures for sure.
Just who will end up paying that bill isn't clear. Claims against the city water department are statutorily capped at $500,000 per incident. The damages will likely far exceed that limit, as the water department expects 30 to 40 properties to file a claim. And there will likely be a court battle over how to divvy up the department's $500,000 among them, plus legal fights with private insurers over coverage. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
New Jersey is hoping to help local news endeavors in a time when community coverage is in decline across the country. The effort to set aside $5 million for the Civic Information Consortium in the state budget was spearheaded by the nonprofit Free Press Action Fund. Joining me is the state director for Free Press Action Fund, Mike Rispoli. Mike, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
As a former journalist, you certainly know the need, but how were you able to garner public and political support for the effort?
Since 2015, Free Press has been working in communities all around New Jersey, listening to residents and their concerns about local news coverage, in particular in underserved communities where a local news outlet used to be there, or lots of journalists were covering that community but have since gone away. So over the course of those 3 years, we were able to build deep relationships with members of the public, talking about the value of local news, talking about the need to create a new infrastructure for local media. And so when we began this campaign, the public responded in a really positive way. And I think that was because they feel very deeply the loss of local news, with thousands of reporters that have been laid off, dozens of newsrooms that have closed down over the past decade. There are many communities around the state that get little to no coverage. And that's not just bad for journalism, that's bad for the civic health of our communities. Studies have shown what happens when local news disappears or is deficient. Fewer people run for public office, fewer people vote, fewer people volunteer. Civic participation drops. And we've also seen studies that have shown that, especially in investigative reporting, for every dollar that's spent in news production, hundreds of dollars are produced in the public's benefit. So when we're talking about supporting local news in New Jersey, it's not just about supporting the journalism industry. It's really about supporting the civic health of our communities. And I think people responded in a positive way to this campaign because they want to be able to get basic information about where they live. They want to know what's happening in their schools, at their local city council meetings, so that they can better participate in their community.
How did that clamor translate into political support?
Well, we worked very closely with the majority leaders in the Senate and the Assembly, Senator Loretta Weinberg and Assemblyman Lou Greenwald. They were champions of this bill from the start. But we worked in communities all around the state to contact their local lawmakers to tell them about what the loss in local news coverage has meant to them and to their community.
And so how is the Civic Information Consortium structured?
The Civic Information Consortium will be made up of a 15-member bipartisan board made up of state appointees, representatives from universities, and representatives from communities in New Jersey, as well as the media and technology sector. And there will be an independent staff, an executive director and program officers, and they will oversee a public charity which will take that initial $5 million and invest it into innovative ideas when it comes to news and information around the state, as well as investing in quality, trustworthy journalism outlets that are already out there to strengthen their coverage.
To what extent is there a concern that among the 15-member board are four appointees, two from the governor and two from the legislature, and with that, the potential for government interference?
Often, when we were out in communities, that was almost the number one question we got from the public, and it is a concern, and I appreciate the skepticism. So we try to address that in crafting this legislation. Number one, the board size is meant to counteract any political appointees having undue influence in making decisions about who gets grants. So that's why there's university representatives as well as representatives from communities and the media and technology sector. Number two, there are clauses in the bill that prohibit either state government or universities from affecting or influencing the type of coverage that would be generated by those who receive grants. And I think the third thing I would say is there's already a precedent for governments investing in media, and that's public media. So we've already seen that governments do invest in media, in journalism, and it produces great independent journalism. And we believe that this is a reimagining of what public interest media can look like.
Thank you so much for joining us to explain the endeavor on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks.
State Director for Free Press Action Fund, Mike Rispoli, on NewsWorks Tonight. At the beginning of this year, Philadelphia officials announced support for opening a supervised injection site, places where people can bring in and inject illicit drugs under medical supervision. If they overdose, staff is on hand to respond. It's a controversial approach in the United States, but one of the drivers of the city's support stemmed from a trip last fall to Vancouver, home to North America's first public injection site. It's a place called Insight, Police in Philadelphia spoke with police in Vancouver.
For me, I went from being adamantly against it just to having an open mind.
As did the fire chief.
The site visits really did change my mind.
As officials here look to lessons from Vancouver to combat an unprecedented overdose crisis, the Pulse's Alana Gordon traced their steps to see how it works.
By the time Matt Savage was a teen, he was living on the streets of Ontario. It was the late 80s. He then became addicted to heroin. He moved to Vancouver, where he says he'd feed his addiction in horrible conditions.
I remember when it was hard to find syringes and not being able to find a place. You know, having friends OD, finding friends that had OD'd, you know, in parkades and things like that.
Savage says the stigma of being an injection drug user made it hard to seek help then. He wanted a better option. Then in 2003, Insight opened, a sanctioned place where people could inject drugs with medical staff present without fear of arrest.
I thought it was pretty groundbreaking, actually. You know, it was acknowledgement that, okay, the drugs are here, you know, and people need to have a safe place to do it.
Savage is 44 now and has stopped using, but says he might not be here today if it weren't for Insight. He OD'd there a few years ago.
I don't even remember finishing the shot. I just remember bringing it up and, you know, starting to do it, and it was going in and then coming to. And that was it. It was that easy. And I went out. They said, the one nurse actually watched me just go right out.
The nurse responded, giving him oxygen and the overdose-reversing medication Naloxone. Insight is located in the thick of a neighborhood in downtown Vancouver that's a major hub for drugs. The facility gets busy. Darwin Fisher is Insight's program coordinator.
After about 2-3 million visits that we've had, it looks a mildly shop-worn, but it's not by any means grody.
Fisher says since Insight opened 15 years ago, no one has ever died there or at any other supervised injection facility around the world.
There's a message urging people to drink water.
Fisher shows me around the place before it opens. How it works is people come in and sign in with a code name. Fisher says the less bureaucratic, the better. The aim is to develop relationships. Past the front room is a big open area, the inner sanctum for supervised injection. It's quiet now, but Fisher says once 9 a.m. hits, the energy shifts.
When it's open, this room that looks like a sort of dimly lit hair salon with bright lights over the booths, this room will have music playing in it. It'll be full of conversation and people. It will really feel vibrant that way. It's a really unique healthcare space.
Picture 13 mirrored booths lined against the wall with spotlights over them. There's also a station with lots of supplies like clean needles and an elevated area where nurses are on hand. People will then settle into their individual booths, unpack the drug they brought, and do their thing, prepping and injecting it. It's a ritual that happens here hundreds of times a day. How long can people stay here?
We do not have time limits on booths. People may need time to split their doses, especially with the rise of fentanyl in the drug supply. People may need time to use safely for various reasons, difficulty locating veins. We're also mindful that this is a respite from the street, and at times it may be tough for people to leave the only situation that feels vaguely safe for them in a day.
Next to the injection space is a private room for health visits and a chill-out area where people can drink water and coffee and talk with peers and counselors. On the second floor is an affiliated addiction center that has detox beds and long-term recovery services.
And that's the enabling that goes on when people come to these sites. They don't enable drug use. What they enable is access to running water, access to quality nursing care and compassion, and access to detox and other services people need. They're not getting that access behind the dumpsters in the alleys.
Researchers have been closely studying Insight ever since it opened, and they found that it reduced overdoses in the area. Same with outdoor use. It's prevented overdose deaths and the spread of HIV. People coming here have also been more likely to access recovery services. And so today, Insight is widely embraced in Vancouver. As cities stateside debate opening such a place, Fisher says curious visitors have flocked here to check things out.
San Francisco has been up here en masse. So folks from Colorado have been interested as well. New York sent up some reps from their police department. The mayor of Ithaca was up, who is ridiculously young.
He says visitors of all ages have similar questions.
They want the site demystified. I think that we accrue in the media a lot of misperceptions around people who use drugs and how to intervene with them.
At least a dozen cities here in the U.S. are now considering supervised injection sites. New York recently announced plans to open 4 of them. Seattle is considering a mobile van. But all these places face uncertainties. Scott Burris is a law professor at Temple University.
We have a federal government that will say it's illegal and may take unpredictable action against any city or other provider that tries to start one.
Supervised injection is technically illegal in the U.S., so it's unclear whether the Trump administration might shut down any place that opens, and even arrest people, or just send a warning. Eva Gladstein is Deputy Managing Director for Health and Human Services in Philadelphia.
We have not determined what the legal strategy might be.
In Vancouver, InSite first opened as a pilot under the condition that it would be closely evaluated. Gladstein says beyond legal uncertainties here, Philadelphia is still trying to figure out how an injection site would work and where it would even go. The city is also looking for outside supporters to fund and run it. So far, community debates have also been contentious.
We're now encouraging and supporting smaller conversations with smaller groups, because I think a part of this, in addition to the logistical or legal issues or whatever, is really having the community understand and support.
Back in Vancouver, support for opening InSite took years, and many more years of legal battles after it opened to secure its place, battles that went all the way to the Supreme Court. Gladstein says when officials announced their support for a site in Philadelphia last winter, no one expected anything would get off the ground quickly. Because despite all the lessons being learned from our neighbor to the north, she and others say it's still uncharted territory here. Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
Tune into The Pulse tomorrow for a special episode about opioids and to hear more about what's happening in Vancouver and how the deadly wave of fentanyl has pushed supervised injection into new and unconventional spaces. The Pulse, tomorrow morning at 9 on WHYY-FM. A church in Wilmington, Delaware, is working to serve more than just the flock's spiritual needs. From WHYY's Delaware desk, Mark Eichmann reports it's mixing exercise classes into the Sunday morning routine.
Come on, we'll give them faith in the house. Come on, put those hands together.
A typical Sunday service at the Resurrection Center in Wilmington starts off with worship music that greets parishioners as they enter. That's followed by a sermon from Pastor Todd Townsend.
I want you to become a party animal for the Lord. Amen.
After the service is over, some members of the congregation trade their Sunday bests for workout clothes, lacing up their sneakers to jab, punch, and pump iron at one of several group fitness classes offered at the church's Movement Center. There's even a drumstick-based class to get folks moving to the beat. Janika Irvin is one of the instructors.
We never thought we would be here, right? Because you don't think church and fitness, and then you're thinking about music.
But working out at the church doesn't seem unconventional at all for James Fuel.
This is not a one-dimensional church, right? Yes, God is the center, okay? And they don't sway or reinvent the Bible. But the pastors and co-pastors, in my opinion, even though they're biblically sound, they're very fitness conscious and health conscious, so that overflows into the rest of the church programs.
On Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays, you can find Pastor Townsend and other instructors leading classes.
I think my wife had a huge part in that. Matter of fact, we call her the fitness police, and so I live with the fitness police. We are now certified in 5 different areas of fitness. Our children are certified. So it's not just a family hobby. It became a lifestyle.
Pastor Cleo Townsend says they wanted an easy way to share their health-conscious lifestyle with their church and community. So why not bring it right into the sanctuary?
Everybody wants to feel well and to be able to run up a flight of steps and not be huffing and puffing. You know, we all want that. But the convenience factor helps. And so by having it at our church, you know, people first come in and they're like curious, let me see what's going on, how's this? And after a while they come in, and then by word of mouth, then they're bringing somebody from that lives down the street from them, from their block. So it begins to spread out into the community.
Word of mouth is how Tiffany Richardson was drawn in.
I found out about the classes. My brother Darren, he's actually an instructor for the body combat class. And my sister, she said, just come along. I need somebody to go with me. And I said, all right, that's no problem. And I'm glad I, you know, signed up for the classes.
Karen Robbins says being active and moving about was already part of her Sunday routine, even when not in exercise class.
When you worship in our church, when we worship, it, to me, it's like letting it all out. It's like you don't hold back. You clap, you pat your foot, you dance, you walk around the church, you jump. When I hear something sometimes, a song or a hymn, I get so excited over him sometimes that I just want to let myself go. And I do that because I feel like I'm worshiping, I'm exalting God, and at the same time, I'm releasing whatever tension and whatever else that's going on inside of me.
The Townsends have also helped a few students become certified instructors, and the benefits of having fitness available at church seems to be paying off.
My best success stories when I hear women say, I can do 5 push-ups now, or I can do push-ups on my toes where I could only do them on my knees. I'm stronger, or I can see definition in my arms. That's what excites me.
In the near future, the pastors hope to add classes on healthy eating and managing stress. From the Delaware Desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.